Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Earlier this week, the National Institutes of Health announced plans for an elaborate retirement home for chimpanzees, veterans of biomedical research. Now, once that primate condo, complete with moats and an education center, is up and running, backers say as many as 300 chimps will live there. Now, the news is being regarded as another small victory in a much larger war waged by humans who want more rights for animals, or non-human animals, as some would say. Think about it, it's all around us. Animals get annoyed every time someone switches to a vegan diet, every time someone stops wearing leather, every time you hear a pet owner referring to herself as a pet guardian. While the push against animal testing in research labs is ongoing and growing. Connection listeners, what are the rights of animals? Should a chimpanzee or a dolphin have the same rights as a person? More to the point, is a chimp a person? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guests this hour are Paul Waldo. He is a clinical assistant professor at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. Though he's not a vet, he's a lawyer. He teaches animal rights at Boston College and Harvard Law Schools. Richard Epstein's with us. He is a law professor at the University of Chicago. He writes and speaks regularly, cautioning against a wholesale embracing of animal rights. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Paul, let me start with you. This, what's it called? Chimp Haven, Inc. Is it considered to be a step along the way towards the level of animal rights or non-human animal rights that's on the table here?
Dick, it's really another step in additional protections. There are certain animal advocates who would see shortcomings in that step, but it's clearly part of a larger process in which additional steps are being taken to protect chimpanzees. These are chimpanzees that have done a remarkable amount of service in the sense that they've given a lot of their lives to important causes. There are other kinds of sanctuaries, however, that some would prefer, but I think overall it's fair to say that Chimp Haven and the recent developments are an important step in a trajectory towards more protections.
Okay, take me to your sense of what the end of that trajectory would look like.
The legal system has a lot of tools in it which offer all kinds of protections to humans. Many of those protections would work very well for other animals. Rights might be involved, but there are other protections as well. And at the end, I think the real goal is to allow those animals to live their lives out in fulfillment of their basic natures in their societies and in terms of their own interests rather than in terms of our interests.
Okay, Richard Epstein, mark this for me in your book, because as I go back through the move towards animal rights, I see your name popping up on a regular basis as saying, whoa, wait a minute. Are you concerned about this?
Well, it depends on how you articulate the question. If the issue is human protection for animals, which is the way that Paul just put it, I think everybody, in some extent, is in favor of that. There are no legal requirements that owners of horses put their studs out to pasture when they're no longer valuable, but Secretariat died a very happy life. The question is not protection. On that, we can have all sorts of debates as to what sorts and how. The question of entitlement, of course, is a rather different thing, because the entitlements that would be created are vastly stronger than, you know, nice care for animals after they've done yeoman-human service. It would mean, in effect, the end to biomedical research on the grounds that chimps, in accordance with their own natures, would never be subject to any kinds of testing, and so therefore you would have to stop it. So I think Paul was being, in effect, much more, shall we say, cooperative and less confrontational when he used the word protection and backed off the word right. It's the word right that sets up real alarm bells in me.
Is it one you have to be careful with, Paul, the use of the word right, the way Richard's talking about it?
Well, it's clear that rights is the flagship concept in the legal system, and in many situations I think it would be appropriate. Steve Wise is the best-known advocate of specific rights, and he has named two particular rights. Whenever anyone talks about rights, you need to talk about which specific rights for which specific animals, and his first book Rattling the Cage does that in great detail. It's a very interesting argument. Not everybody who advocates further protections for other animals agrees that legal rights is the way to go, but it's clearly a very interesting concept, and it can be used, I think, quite valuably with regard to chimpanzees in the present situation.
Don't animals have legal rights now?
Well, that's a very interesting point. There are certain legal protections in place, such as the anti-cruelty protection or the anti-cruelty laws. But, for example, more than half the states in the last decade have passed laws that say that those laws do not apply to food animal production, the vast number of animals that we encounter in our human society. There is also a serious problem with regard to enforcement of those laws, even when they're held to be applicable. There are respected scholars such as Cass Sunstein, Richard's colleague at the University of Chicago, who would make arguments that there are legal rights in place right now. I think that that argument needs to be worked out very carefully. I think it's fair to say that overall the legal rights favor humans, and when it's feasible or in humans' interest to waive the protections of other animals, that's done regularly.
Yeah, I think the answer is claims about existing rights of animals are not certainly recognized as a common law matter. You could create a statute which says that certain animals have guardians and those animals have rights. People who own animals and die and who create trusts for the benefit of those animals essentially have made them beneficiaries under trust. And one of the things I think that's so absolutely important about this discussion is that the moment one starts to talk about rights, it's too easy to lump and jump immediately into the case of we need government regulation and protection. Private ownership in some cases is a license to kill an animal, but in many cases it's a license to protect it. And under these circumstances, if you could have private arrangements which protect things through sanctuaries and so forth, so much the better, because it would avoid the enormous friction that takes place when these things become confrontational and legislative.
Okay, but let's if we can, for the purposes of the conversation, try to zero in on the great apes, the chimpanzees, the bonobos, gorillas, what am I missing? The orangutans.
Orangutans.
Who, for over whom the conversation is, and or the argument is being waged about whether or not they could ever have the same or equivalent rights to humans.
Well, at some level, it's clearly an exaggeration. Even Stephen recognizes that you're not going to give apes the right to vote, for example, or to own corporate shares or things of that sort. He's talking about rights of property and autonomy. And it seems to me that once you recognize the enormous gulf required by the differences in natural facilities, to talk about rights is to simply obscure the set of differences and to create all sorts of expectations which in the end probably cannot and ought not to be satisfied. That is, I mean, right now everybody believes that primates are entitled to more protection than other forms of animals. We don't eat them routinely, and medical experimentation, even before the creation of the sanctuary, was heavily regulated and guarded. And my own view about it is that if one thinks that there are certain cases of abuses, you make incremental corrections. But to have this grand theory of rights will require you to develop judgments about cognition on the one hand, or suffering on the other, and you'll never be able to limit it to the great apes. One of the things that Stephen finds so difficult in his own book is every test that he does to create the chimps turns out to protect the rat as well, because you can't devise a scale on intelligence, which means that those cunning little creatures flunk.
Okay, Paul, I ask the listeners, I'll ask you, is a chimp a person?
Think of it this way. Many of the native languages around the world reflect that native peoples talked about, let's say, orangutans as persons. In fact, orangutan in the local language of Indonesia translates as person of the forest. So it's quite feasible when you have had an extended relationship with an orangutan or a gorilla, a chimpanzee or a bonobo, to understand them as a person. For example, Roger Fouts' book, Next of Kin, is an extended treatment of Washo, a language-trained chimpanzee, and I don't think anyone can read that book without coming away with the sense that she is a person in every sense of the word, every sense of the word. I'm pleased to hear Richard make the point that when rights are discussed, it's not the same set of rights for these non-human persons. It's not giving them keys to the car or rights to
vote.
But what is at issue are these very high-level protections. For example, in the United States, you can now buy a chimpanzee on the internet. You can go on the internet and find chimpanzees for sale. It is quite feasible to give chimpanzees legal protections, whether you call them rights or not is not particularly germane, which prohibits that kind of a transaction. That's done in many other countries. Legal systems can affect that, and the U.S. system can affect that right now.
But
can I answer the person question for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
And it seems to me that there's a big difference between saying that animals have personalities and that animals are people. And one of the things I think that everybody knows when you own a dog or a horse and so forth is some of them are nice and some of them are vicious and some of them are impatient and some of them are understanding. And you could use all those human predicates with respect to animals. But if you're talking about the word person and not personality, the test is whether or not they could breed with others of the same species. And the answer is they are not human beings, even though they have personalities.
But you yourself, in discussing this in your writing, Richard, you talk about, you know, a measure of the intellectual ability, a measure of emotional feelings, and whether or not those are accurate gauges.
There's no question. You don't want to sort of end this debate by pretending, as people really have never done, that all animals are automatons, so in effect, you find an animal, find a stone. The question you have to do is, given the infinite gradations across species within nature, what particular set of rules makes sense for them and to us? And the idea that we're going to sort of treat them as essentially people or things or whatever it is you want to call them, whom we cannot invade their space, I think in effect creates such an enormous revolution that the level of inconvenience or suffering or hardship that human beings would suffer in consequence of this is so great that you cannot implement the rights program of somebody like Stephen Wise on a coherent basis. You could certainly make incremental adjustments on protections, but I think if one were to be aware of the costs in terms of human satisfactions and standard of living and mortality risks and medical advances that are at stake, most people would say, gee, I'm not prepared to go that far, and I think they're right.
I think an important point to make is that arguing that a chimpanzee is a person is not the equivalent to arguing that a chimpanzee is a human being. It might be the case that chimpanzees are have equivalent status in certain circumstances to human beings, but it's not to say that they are human beings. They are chimpanzees, very complex animals socially, cognitively, intellectually, and gifted at living their own lives. They're actually fairly skilled at picking up our language. What are they doing with that intelligence back in their own world, in their own situation where their mother raises them and they have complex learning situations such that someone like Richard Wrangham at Harvard would call what they do culture? Now, there is a long tradition here of never using these high-quality words for non-human animals, culture, person, and certain other prized concepts. But what is fascinating across the academy and in society right now is that people begin to recognize that these terms have lots of purchase with certain other animals, the big-brained social animals that are recognizably complex and have personalities. But I would agree with Richard that they're not human beings, but I don't think that equates to them not being legal persons or significant persons in a moral sense.
I think there's something else, though, which is, again, if you look at Richard Wrangham, he also wrote this wonderful book explaining how it is that one tribe of chimpanzees systematically exterminated another. This is a case in which it turns out that these animals are not only specious with respect to everybody, other species on the face of the earth, but they also turn out to be quite warlike with respect to their own rival tribes. And so the great question we have is when we start to talk about, as it were, respecting them and giving them massive autonomy, what do we do when they decide not to respect autonomy within their own species?
Hang on a sec. People do the same thing, don't they?
Yes, and we try to stop that within people. But, I mean, one of the things that I think that the ethologists would say, and it's one of the real problems here, is are we going to go out into the wild when we see some chimpanzees killing monkeys or killing each other and say, you know, our human values are such that we're going to prevent them from doing this? I mean, there is a very powerful difference between the ethological view of what animals are and what the human rights view are. And I think, in effect, there's a peculiar form of human domination in which we're going to impose our values on all other species if, in fact, we're going to demand that they follow human norms and don't be specious themselves.
Let me just stop you there, Richard. We have to take a break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, you can get your word in. 1-800-423-TALK. Ethics, morality, physical distinctions, rights. That's what we're talking about as we look at the differences or the similarities between animals and people. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Think for a minute about the way these two pairs of words sound. Human rights. We get it. Animal rights. Not the same thing. Some people would like the two to be considered much more closely together. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we want to hear from you on this. With me in the studio, Paul Waldo. He is assistant clinical professor at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine, author of The Specter of Species. I hate this word. Speciesism.
Good luck.
Yeah, Buddhist and Christian views of animals. He's also vice president of the Great Ape Project International. Richard Epstein is a professor of law at the University of Chicago, author of a number of books, including Principles for a Free Society, Reconciling Individual Liberty with the Common Good, and a man who has often accused himself of being a speciesist. Is that right, Richard?
Oh, absolutely. I don't understand how you conduct a discussion of this sort unless you do that. I mean, even the animal rights people have to believe, to some extent, believe in species differences because they recognize that it doesn't make sense to talk about voting rights and driving rights with respect to chimpanzees, and that's a perfectly categorical judgment. I mean, I think we're all guilty of the sin, and it's not a sin. It's just an inevitable feature of nature. The right question to ask is how, given our superior intellects and power, do we try to organize ourselves vis-a-vis chimps? And the thing that we know, of course, is that if you put this question to a chimp, no matter what their levels of culture and achievement, they could not give it an intelligent answer. And therein lies the fundamental difference between us.
Well, speciesism is a term works a lot of different ways. I think the best definition, the one that comes out of the historical use of the term, is that it's the claim that only members of your species matter morally. Only members of your species matter morally.
Well, then no one is a species, you see. Well, I mean, at that point, the term is drained of all possible meaning because anyone who's in favor of animal protection is, by your definition, not a species.
Well, but, Richard, take a look at the history and how many people have claimed that only humans matter. Now, it's true that in daily life, many people have some non-humans matter, but in the institutional sense, from the Catholic Church to many governments around the world, there are people who very aggressively claim that other animals are here for us. Now, the most important thing, I think, is that although...
Go ahead.
Take a look at the situation, not in the wild, Richard, what you point out, and I'm glad that you do, because the wild situation is particularly horrific. Obscene, I think, is a good description of it. But there are 3,000 captive chimpanzees, gorillas, et cetera, in the United States. Now, they don't belong in our midst. They don't belong exhibited for our entertainment. These are complex animals which we could allow to live outside of ourselves. I don't think we should police them in any way. We don't have the ability to do that. They need our policing like they need a hole in the head, which is really what we've been driving in many ways in our biomedical research. The point here is that we don't have to run the world. We can respect our own species and let them live their lives. And even if we like our species more, it doesn't mean we strip them of all moral and legal protections.
Quickly,
well,
Richard, because
I
want to get to calls, so I'll ask you to be brief if I can.
Again, it's just much too dichotomous. I mean, yes, men, 3,000 are here, but is the question, do we now basically close down all zoos and do we stop all medical research? Putting it in that particular form, the choices are much more difficult because it turns out there are huge amounts of human losses that are going to be suffered. And it's one thing to say, gee, now we'll do it, but if we had adopted these policies 100 years ago, life expectancies would be 15 years.
Human losses short. Such as what? If a zoo is closed down?
Oh, come on. I mean, huge amounts of understanding about animals, for starters.
Oh, you're talking about study, not exhibition.
Well, even exhibition is a form of instruction.
1-800-423-8255. First to Hillsborough, North Carolina. Mark's on the line. Hi, Mark.
Yes, hi. Thank you. My comment is based on a book that changed my entire life. It's called The Bhagavad Gita As It Is by Bhaktivedanta Swami. He's the founder of the Hare Krishna movement. And the topic, I'm a little sick today, I'm lying in bed, but the topic immediately caught my attention and I wanted to call. Just by reading the beginning of the book, the book delves into the question of matter, spirit, what is consciousness, what is life, which are vitally important questions for the entire society, the way we view ourselves, the way we view are the human beings and the way we view all living beings. And according to Bhagavad Gita, every living being is a soul.
Is that the definition, though, that when I ask the question, are chimps people, it's like, no, Dick, not people, souls. And a chimp is a soul.
Well, absolutely, they're people. We're all people. They're just like an infant child is a person. The consciousness is not developed, and the consciousness is not as developed as it will become. Similarly,
and
animal,
Richard Epstein wants to know if you think that bacteria is also a people.
Yes, but in a very, very limited state of consciousness due to karma.
That means, let's take it, we don't use penicillin.
No, I will use penicillin. Why wouldn't I use penicillin?
Well, I mean, because what happens is you're extinguishing souls.
Well, there's certain question of practicality. Certain things are intended for human use, like vegetable. You know, we can understand vegetables, grains.
Why is that? When you use them for human beings, you're precluding them from nature. When you breed animals or vegetables, even plant life, selectively you change their fundamental natures. They are no longer self-generating.
Well, some of these questions may get a little complicated, I'd like to stick just to the basic point that I was making, that
go for it,
all living beings are, and if we examine, we can see the many forms that we may have a pet dog that seems more intelligent than an infant child. It's not that, now maybe I should decide to cook and eat my infant child. He's less intelligent. No, the infant child will one day, he will become intelligent. There's a process of spiritual evolution that's going on, not material evolution.
Paul Waldo, it's about drawing lines to a certain extent, because if you're going to use the gauge of consciousness, if you're going to use the gauge of the sentient nature of the creature, then you can say that the four great apes are above this certain level, that the dolphin is here on the scale, but that the rat and the cat and the flower and the bacteria are so on down. In terms of establishing rights, if that's where we keep the conversation, you're obliged to make a class system, aren't you?
Well, it's clearly the case if we're going to take practical steps and change the existing situation, which has such serious inadequacies that it needs to be changed, that you have to take practical steps. So we focus, for example, on chimpanzees because they're demonstrably complex. Some of the other animals you mentioned are as well. They're the obvious first steps. For example, there's a group called the Chimpanzee Collaboratory out of Seattle, funded by the Glaser Foundation, which tries to work in a coalition effort to protect these animals. It doesn't mean by protecting just chimpanzees they don't care about elephants or dolphins. Mm-hmm. It means, though, that we have incredibly high-quality scientific information which allows us to go into a sophisticated realm like the courtroom and make sophisticated arguments like Richard is able to make or Steve Wise is able to make and argue out in a very reasonable way. Chimpanzees are a wonderful area to work on that, and that's the current cutting edge. These other issues, we may eventually get there.
You see, the interesting point about this is you don't need any new laws to create a conservatory in which you implement your policies and protect chimpanzees in whatever form you see fit. And my own view about this is that what you're interested in is not only the chimpanzees you own, but those which are owned by medical laboratories of one kind or another. And the real question is whether any chimpanzee should be used for medical research. And my attitude is if it's going to cost the lives of 10 chimpanzees in order to develop a suitable technique for organ transplantation or a cure for AIDS, count me on. It's not that I feel that there's no cost, but in terms of who I am and the other people who are suffering, I think that's a trade-off that I'm prepared to make.
It's a personal trade-off that you're making.
No, it's not. It's a social trade-off.
What if I say, okay, I would count as the death of 5, but certainly not 10?
Well, I understand that there's going to have to be collective deliberations on drawing the line. Everybody understands that. But the point is, the difference between you and me is that I'm willing to concede that you have total dominion over the animals that you own and can treat them whatever way, shape, and form you see fit, including enlightened conservation things, and you're not prepared to allow any animals to be used in any way that you don't think it. I'm trying to enable you, and you're trying to veto me, and that's the fundamental asymmetry between us.
But, Richard, historically, it's been important across time to step into what other people consider property. Slaves were property. Women were property. We had to disabuse people of the notion that was easily property without moral problem. That's also the case with chimpanzees.
No, that's exactly the importance of speciesism as an important concept. The reason why you have such strong moral purchase with respect to women and slaves, whose position was really very different from animals and from each other, is precisely because they are human beings. You could then start to think about a coherent theory of natural rights within the species. And in fact, most of the evolution in libertarian and political thought has been to say that every natural person, by which I mean human being, shall and have certain inalienable rights as the Declaration of Independence. And when we said we the people, we didn't say we the people and we the animals. And we didn't mean that either when we drafted our Constitution. I think, in effect, what we understood is that there was a universal community of human beings, and it seems to me that the great danger is that if we start to say that chimps are just like us, it's not that we're going to raise the level of protection for chimps. I have a real fear that we become a little bit more callous in the way in which we treat other people.
You probably get an argument from some people who would say that we the people may not, in fact, have included African Americans at that
time. Well, I mean,
in
I would
America,
get a very strong.
I don't want to go.
No, that's a cheap shot, which we understand. But remember, we fought a civil war over that because the principle that I stated was that, and it's not as though the guys on the Union side didn't use pack horses when they went after the South.
And Richard, one extra point: no one is claiming chimpanzees are just like humans. They're claiming that on their own merits, we are capable of looking at them and seeing that we can and should protect them because of who they are, not because they're like us, but because of who they are.
Well, I agree with that. If the question is, do we protect some chimps? But the issue is not whether we protect some chimps, it's whether we allow any chimps to be used for medical research. And it seems to me at that point you have to think of what the costs and benefits are, looking at this globally, taking into account human interests as well.
Richard, I got to stop you guys. We actually have people crawling through the phone lines trying to involve themselves in this, and we're being selfish. 1-800-423-8255, or at least I am. And we'll go to Somerville, Massachusetts first. David's first up. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
I come down emotionally on this with the animal guy, but I offer an experience of mine that I think helps the other fellow. I'm an investigator, private investigator, and I have had in the last 10 years two cases that fit this fact set. Wealthy person loves her cats or her dogs very much, has a lot of money, and is manipulated by her caretakers. Who essentially use the animal's inheritance rights for that money to deprive her natural heirs of vast amounts of money. What do you guys think of that?
If it's a fraud case under a will, the animals have no more right to it than does the young bimbo who manages to steal money from anybody else. So I don't think that's a question of animal rights in terms of the issues here. I think it's a question in which animals are used as a device and an artifice to commit fraud.
I think David used
the word. No, but the woman in both these cases definitely knew in every way that she was leaving these millions to her cats in one case, dogs
then
in another.
Then the question is whether or not this was a fully informed decision or whether or not she was subject to undue influence. And it's the same question you would have if the beneficiaries of the money were somebody else. I'm not saying that it was right or wrong one way or another. I'm saying that there's nothing about the animals in that case that gives rise to the issues we're facing here.
David's right. The use of the term manipulation, David, keys the fact that there are going to be other legal concepts which you can bring into play. Don't have to bring in this human, non-human animal divide issue.
1-800-423.
I'll move on to it if I can. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, David. Quick last one to you.
If I can move on to another suggestion, though. I believe that there's perhaps there's some sort of commonsensical line here that could be drawn. Perhaps there should be some due process whereby a scientist would have to get a judge's order to allow for experimenting on a higher level animal.
I don't think you want judges in the midst of this. You want general protocols, which can be done administratively. There are thousands of laboratories in the United States, hundreds of laboratory animals in each of these experiments. To have a judge overview each of these things is to put them in a position where even they don't want to be.
But Stephen Wise has written, if I'm characterizing him accurately, that in fact the definition of animal rights as it moves ahead is best left with the judges, best left with the courts, who have that so historical understanding of rights, and perhaps not the amount of emotional attachment to concepts of whether or not an animal is a person, is a creature, is a human. I'm not sure if I've put his argument accurately.
No. Well, Stephen's basic argument is that since you're talking about negative rights to liberty and security, courts are familiar with that. But what David has suggested is that we're going to allow experimentation on a case-by-case for cause basis. Stephen would be so opposed at the basic concept, he wouldn't even spend any time figuring out how to implement it. But if you're going to have experimentation, as I think we ought to, this is the worst possible way to do it.
If we took, for example, David, Tibetan orphans and put them in the potential experimental subjects, would you want courts to make that on a case-by-case basis because we could get some benefits out of doing that? There's an absolute bar on doing that. Groups like the Great Ape Project would say there should also be an absolute bar with certain other animals. In fact, maybe with many other animals if you can marshal the scientific evidence. But we now have the scientific evidence to show that there are incredibly sophisticated arguments that appeal broadly to lawyers, judges, to many people in society if we open our minds to that possibility. Concentrating on chimpanzees is a very good way to show that the system is quite limited right now and needs to be opened up.
Let's move along. 1-800-423-8255. David, thanks for your call. To another David now on the line from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. David, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. A fascinating conversation. Guys, when you talk about rights, human rights, animal rights, I think there's a dignity right for every being. And I don't want to take it to the point of absurdity like mole or bacteria or anything like that. But we can tell when things are being mistreated. We can tell when people are being mistreated. We can tell when animals are being mistreated.
Let me just pause for half a second while I give a network cue. This is The Connection from National Public Radio. David, you say that you don't give it to certain, but you do give it to some.
No, I didn't say that. I said, let's not take it to the point of absurdity.
Yeah, okay, but how do you back off that point of absurdity? I'm not taking issue with what you're saying. I'm saying, all right, be specific. Where's the line where something becomes absurd?
Well, we give everyone rights that they should... no cruel and unusual punishment. I think that would be kind of a line. Okay.
Well, that of course is the cruelty movement of the 19th century. It's not the animal rights movement of the 20th century.
Well, I don't care what time it was. Okay. What I'm saying is we need to treat everything with dignity and respect, and everything is here for a reason, and we're supposed to be the shepherds of everything on the planet.
I'm not playing games with you here, okay. But if I step on an ant or if I kill a mouse in a trap because it's
in my
kitchen,
I don't have a problem with that. I'm saying when we're doing things, we know when we're being extremely cruel to a chimpanzee or to a dolphin or something else. We know how to do things, and we know how to do things well. And we know when we can do experiments, and you could put these animals, at least make them comfortable or to a point. When you do an operation on a human, do you let him suffer or do you give him something so he can make it through? Okay. Well, and I guess, yes, we have to look at the level of the animal. But we know when we're being extremely cruel and unreasonable.
David, thank you for your call. We have to step away for a short break. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and we will talk about dignity when we come back, whether or not there's a legal definition that's useful in our understanding of the direction that society's going in a closer or communal or group concept of what these rights are. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, we're talking about animal rights as they're understood legally, as we understand them morally, and whether or not we're watching any kind of a shift in the way that understanding is accepted in society. With me on the program, Richard Epstein. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Paul Waldo is also here. He's an assistant clinical professor at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. He's a lawyer who teaches animal rights at Harvard and Boston College Law School. And Paul, I want to start where we left with David's use of the word dignity, because whether I'm reading what's written by people who have serious reservations about animal rights or people who are pushing them very hard, dignity comes up a lot.
Dignity is a wonderful word. In the legal realm, it's very vague. The European Union has mandated in its protocols that all farm animals be accorded dignity, but it's very difficult to define. I think it's fair to say that dignity follows legal persons. In the current system, only humans are legal persons. But we could go to Hinduism, Buddhism, the Islamic tradition, Judaism, Christianity, and find dignity used regarding not only humans but many other animals. And I think much of the push to get legal protections extended to other animals, legal rights extended, is the recognition that dignity is a word that applies to other animals and that we're very much out of sync on that basic intuition right now in the legal system.
But again, it's also, as we said, a very slippery word. Hindus have dignity to cows and treat them as sacred. Judaism has dignity for animals, and it prescribes detailed rules for the slaughter under the kashrut, under the kosher codes. They're not the same concept. It cashes out in terms of the farm animals simply as being a prohibition against cruelty and deprivation. It cannot crash out as sort of having a respect for the decent opinions of mankind because the cognitive abilities simply aren't there. And dignity, therefore, depends not only on what you can give but what others can receive.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And Sandra's on the line. Hi, Sandra.
Hello. I think the use of rights in the discussion is very troublesome. Basically, I am a lawyer, and basically rights are carved out claims that one has against the sovereign. It's a legal fiction. At one time we said that people of African descent did not have rights because they were not persons. Then after the Civil War, we said they were persons. Excuse me. And that worked pretty well because they were able to actually stand up in court and assert what they wanted. Then we said that we could grant rights to corporations who are not even things. They are abstract concepts. And then you have the question, who will speak for the corporation? And you see, that is the question that you will always get into when you do not have someone who can come in and actually talk to the courts. Children's rights, for example, are often a debate between the parent asserting the rights and the state asserting the rights. So what you are talking about with rights is having a continual fight over who will speak for the animals.
But Sandra,
I think protections is a much better way to deal with the issue.
Sandra, I'm going to let Paul speak about this because I'm not sure that I've got it right, but it seems to me that the one of the end goals of the establishment of rights under, when you look at the Great Ape Project or why is this writing, is that someday a chimpanzee will in fact sit in the witness chair in a courtroom using some kind of voice synthesization, like there's another word I'm a little lost on, technique that actually says, yes, I was mistreated, and testifies.
It's clearly the case that chimpanzees have cognitive abilities that could be brought across in a courtroom. I want to suggest to you, though, that
children do, too. That's not the point. The point is children are not in a position to actually be considered able to bring an action until they become 18.
But look,
so
we could always
now you do not have apes that can take the stand. Maybe when we do, we should change our theory. But right now, all you will do is postpone the debate over the real issue, which is what protections should
Sandra,
we give the animals.
Sandra, there are apes that communicate at a level where a jury could understand what was going on and make a decision on that. But I want to suggest to you how inappropriate that is. That means that chimpanzees are in our midst. They have to communicate in our style. That's not what they do in the real world. They are forced into a very artificial situation. Perhaps that would be a meaningful experience, but that is not to be a goal. The goal would be to have them out of our midst living their lives in fulfilling ways.
Yeah, look, I want to talk about the conceptual issues because I think there's a confusion here. You can give rights to anybody. If the person or the thing to whom you give the rights cannot speak for themselves, you could create agents or guardians who will speak for them. And certainly if you wanted to give chimpanzees rights, you could find guardians who would take it. Just the way, for example, today, if you're talking about trust law, we can give rights to unborn children who can't speak for themselves even before conception. But we could always appoint a guardian who will represent their interests. The issue is, do they have interests that we want to protect? And if so, how far do we go? So I think Susan's bottom line is correct, but I don't think that the diversion into children or into corporations deals with the fundamental question of entitlement. There is always a mechanism that you could use for somebody who's unable to express his own opinions when you wish to protect that person.
Can you have the same conversation about morals and ethics when you're putting it under the subtitle of protections, though, which is what Sandra's suggesting?
Absolutely. Sure. But you could have a conversation which says the reason we protect these animals is because we think they have very high levels of cognitive development. In fact, whilst I'm deeply skeptical about animal rights, I'm absolutely somebody who's for a long time believed everything which has been said about the level of cognitive abilities associated with animals. Indeed, what's wrong with the animal rights movement is they pretend that this is all novel stuff. I think any anyone who's done sociobiology in the 70s or animal behavior in the 1930s was well aware of this a long time ago.
Or aware of the history of Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, etc.
Well, I mean, I prefer to sort of keep it to the scientific side rather than to move it to the religious side. But look, no matter which way one does it, whether you talk about souls or so forth, these brains are very high-power computers. They have different switches from the ones that we have. When human cognition developed, we lost other skills because neurons that were devoted to one task were now shifted over and devoted to another. Anybody who sorts of thinks that we're the only game in town is, I think, blind to the way in which the world works. Animals are not what Kant said, mere cattle, sort of anonymous things. They are extremely complicated. That's one of the reasons why we care so much about protecting them. But the issue between protection and rights is the critical one.
Let me go back to the phones if I can. 1-800-423-8255. Sandra, thanks for your call to St. Helena, South Carolina. And Lanny's with us. Hi, Lanny.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. I know Paul Weldahl quite well. Actually, I trained in a sabbatical at the Center for Animals at Tufts, and he came there after me. I disagree quite strongly with the whole concept of rights for animals, but that does not mean, certainly as a veterinarian, as a human being, that we don't have moral obligations towards animals. And I think there's a strong distinction that I think should and could be made. Everyone seems to agree that there's infinite gradations in all the relevant characteristics between, say, the bacteria and the chimpanzee. And because of that, I believe there's infinite gradations in moral standing. And moral standing is at the crux of the issue, because degrees of moral standing, and the higher the level of degree of moral standing, one gets a higher degree of moral protection. And no one would disagree that chimpanzees have probably a second only to persons, humans, a very high level of moral standing.
But Lanny, the argument goes that unless you give the chimpanzee the right not to be tortured, the right not to be imprisoned, the right to life that is definable in law, that more morals simply become anybody's notion of what's morally good at the time, and nothing can be enforced.
Well, I think there are stronger obligations towards chimpanzees than there are for, say, rats, as there are for, slugs. And the reality is, I've been in the field for like 40 years, and I've seen such a tremendous change in the way we respect and use chimpanzees. And one of the reasons that there are so many excessive chimpanzees that are now going into protection in sanctuaries is the fact that scientists have not been able to justify their use in their own community, in their scientific peer evaluating groups, in their IACUCs that judge the value and ethics of the research being done. So they have gained tremendously, and I applaud the fact that many of these chimpanzees are going to go into a sanctuary, but I do not accept the view that under any and all circumstances, chimpanzees should not be used for research. Even Peter Singer, who, of course, is the father of the Great Ape Project, agreed with me when I asked him the question, if you needed to use 10 or 100 chimpanzees and the investigator could say, I'll find a cure for AIDS if they can use it, what would he say? And he would say, go ahead and use them, because the value to the overall, humanity and the overall world is so much in excess of the value that we would place on these relatively few chimpanzees.
Very briefly,
Lanny, just one quick reply. Peter would also say that you could use Peter Singer if you could get those kinds of benefits as well. So Peter's utilitarianism doesn't protect humans. And if you recognize that there need to be fundamental protections, then chimpanzees can certainly be included in that scheme as well.
All right, Lanny, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255. To Bill now, who's on the line in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to describe an incident that happened when I went to the Bronx Zoo. There were a bunch of kids teasing a gorilla, and I think they were ashamed at how human the gorilla looked, because it was really over the top.
You mean teasing him, torturing, throwing stuff at him, or just making fun of him?
Just laughing and pointing their fingers and jumping up and down like gorillas and,
yeah.
Just being obnoxious.
So what did the gorilla do?
And the gorilla stood perfectly erect, put all her weight on one leg, raised her other knee just a teeny bit, put her hand on her hip, like a teapot, and extended her other hand and adopted that classical Greek statue pose that I can't think of the name of. And it was just so dignified. And it was amazing. And she proved to be more human than the children.
Well, actually more dignified than the children, I think. But it's also
She did a human imitation, and I don't know where she could have learned it from.
Look, I think the point that both you've made and that Lanny made is that there are enormous devices for self-equilibration and protection, even if we don't resort to animal rights. Veterinary science is somewhere between 10 and 15 years behind human science. If they were indifferent to animals, it would be in the Stone Age. And by the way, this requires major investments of human resources for animal protection. It takes place under the current system. And it turns out that basically medical research will need fewer chimpanzees as other devices are developed to deal with it, and hopefully the problem could be mitigated in that way. But to take a categorical judgment at this stage when there's so much at stake is probably a mistake. Incremental changes, yes. Total bans, no.
Richard, you have been at or near the center of this debate for a long time. I'm interested in your perspective of how you see it changing, whether or not, despite your you know, warnings and holding your hands up and saying, wait a second, there are much bigger issues at stake here, whether or not it's you're feeling that you're being pushed a little bit on rights, that they are encroaching.
Well, I feel I'm being pushed from both sides. When I talk about this issue in private with people who aren't concerned with the debate, they are so incredulous about the claims on the other side that I end up having to turn out to defend people on the other side rather than to do this. It turns out in the spectrum of American individuals, I am probably much more on the pro-animal side than the median American who's only worried about where his next steak is going to come from. What's happened is, of course, that elites move in very different directions. And if they can move in the opposite way, you could move precipitately too far, too much. And my view is one that, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. I'm not comfortable with everything about it. But incremental adjustments on this matter will do far better than fundamental moral reevaluations of the situation, whether based on religious concepts or the ostensibly latest breaking information about science. I mean, let me put it to you the way I put it the first time I got into this debate 3 years ago, is if somebody had adopted Stephen Wise's or Paul's position in the year 1000 BC, we'd still be in plows, pulling them by human beings, eking out a marginal existence. Human success depended upon the evolution of animals. Now we have succeeded to a point where we may be able to change things, but not as much, I think, as many people suppose. There's not a single
Paul,
person.
What do you think of that?
Richard, I want to suggest to you that the legal system is more flexible than you're suggesting here and that rights would apply. I don't favor applying it as the only tool. It's certainly one that's capable. But I want to say that the extension of rights to other beings, the excluded beings, has always been a difficult task. Those who hold the present rights are always reluctant to give them up. I do think that the legal system has the capacity to do this, but particularly human moral ability has the capacity, and in many other cultures has extended. We now live in an impoverished situation where we think only humans matter. Our legal system puts that in place. We can get beyond it. We need to change the legal
system.
You're
saying the capacity is there.
I mean, look, only human beings matter. Nobody believes that. And that's when you go to the vernacular and you lose the precision that the argument goes off the rails. Everybody believes nothing.
Richard, let me read
matter.
To you just briefly the Catholic Catechism passage 24:15. Animals, they mean non-human animals, like plants and inanimate things, by nature are destined for the use of past, present, and future humanity. That's the official position of a major religious tradition.
And how many Catholics are opposed to rules that limit cruelty to animals?
And how many people think this debate will go on and on? I want to thank both of you for coming in to help us with it. Richard Epstein, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Richard is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Paul Waldo, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Dick.
Paul is at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.